We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Responsibility for medical errors often ends up being argued out in court, or if not in court, it's something that ends up being argued out among lawyers. And I think probably the common assumption that we have is, in a case like that, that the injured parties are looking for money damages. However, people who try to make some study of medical malpractice say, in fact, what a lot of patients are really looking for is an admission by the doctor that mistakes were made. They also hope to prevent future harm to other people. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be trying to talk about apologies and medical errors. And we have two guests with us. Here in studio with me is Jennifer Robinault. She is a professor of law and psychology here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. She's a nationally known scholar in the area of psychology and law, also torts and dispute resolution, and has done some writing on this very subject, that is medical malpractice, medical errors, and apologies. And also joining us by telephone, we have Lawrence Helmkin. He is assistant professor in the School of Public Health at University of Illinois, Chicago. Right now, he's visiting fellow in health and aging research at the National Bureau of Economic Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And he's joining us by telephone, and he is there in Cambridge. And this is a subject also that he's done writing and research on. So as we talk, questions are welcome. We'd like to get in people involved in the show. If you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also email your questions and comments to will-talk, so that's W-I-L-L, will-talk at illinois.edu. Anybody's welcome to join the conversation. We do ask people to try to be brief, just so we can keep things moving along, but anybody who's listening is welcome to join in. And Professor Robinault, thank you.
Thank you.
For being here with us and also joining us on the telephone. Professor Helmkin, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate it. Specifically, we wanted to talk about apologies and medical errors. But I guess I am interested in talking a little bit about looking at this in a little larger sense. I know we talk all the time about the United States being a very litigious society. And so I think we have this idea that if someone feels that they have been harmed, the first thing is, all right, I'm going to get a lawyer and I'm going to sue. There has, although I think now for some time, been a growing interest in other ways of trying to resolve these kind of disputes, maybe short of going to court. At least. And maybe I'll start here with Jennifer Robinault and Professor Helmkin. You can weigh in as well. I guess I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about the ways that we are trying to rethink the whole business of handling a dispute like that, particularly when what we're talking about is someone who believes that they've suffered an injury.
Okay. So the first thing I'll say is that the rate of litigation is actually much lower than we commonly think. So the percentage of people who are injured who actually file lawsuits against those who have injured them is relatively low. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. Sometimes the injury is minor enough that it's not worth all the various costs of bringing a lawsuit. Sometimes it's not exactly clear who the target of the lawsuit should be. Sometimes the case isn't such that an attorney will take the case. And so at the end of the day, it turns out that the claiming rate is actually quite low. But even for those cases that get filed, a vast, vast majority of them are settled without a trial. So for most kinds of cases, the settlement rate is somewhere in the mid-90% of cases that settle through negotiation between the two sides, of course, with the looming trial in the background. And as part of that negotiation process, one of the one of the mechanisms by which courts have tried to find ways other than trial to settle disputes is by engaging in what's called mediation processes. And sometimes these are private and sometimes they're through the court system. So maybe a judge will act as a mediator. And a mediator is someone who is neutral in the dispute and can help the parties with their settlement negotiations. Sometimes that's the two attorneys engaging in the mediation process. And often it means bringing the parties in to sit at the same table so that all of them can get together and try to work out a resolution to their dispute.
Yeah, maybe here I'll turn to Professor Humke, and I think that one of the questions that you might ask, if you're thinking about a different way of dealing with these kinds of disputes, you'd have to ask the question, well, why would you want to do that? What would the benefit be? And I guess that really comes down to this basic question that says, for the person who feels that they have been harmed, what is it that they want? And can we actually say something about what is it that people are really looking for?
Well, there are some studies that suggest that patients are not only in it for the money. They do not only seek compensation for the injury. Often it just starts with the desire to have physicians recognize the harm that they actually suffered an injury in when they were receiving medical care. They also, a lot of physicians have been conditioned by their medical liability insurers not to disclose any kind of information surrounding the incident. And so patients will simply want to learn what occurred and why they're now faced with this adverse outcome that they didn't anticipate. So often it starts with the recognition of an injury, perhaps an explanation. What in fact occurred, maybe a recognition of the responsibility on the part of the provider. Now we're talking already about a possible admission of liability, and then also a pledge to not abandon the patient and to provide some form of remediation, which need not be monetary only. And finally, there might be there's a lot of scope to pledge to put into place corrective actions on the part of the administrators, on the part of the physicians, so that the injury that the patient suffered will not be repeated on other patients.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's anything you'd want to add to that.
I think that's exactly right. Those are the things that patients tend to want. They want compensation financially, but also explanations and assurance that these sorts of things won't happen again. And what I find really interesting is that patients say they want this information sort of unprompted. They want the doctor to come to them and say, this is what happened. These are the consequences. These are the implications for your health. And a lot of doctors feel like if patients want to know those things, the patient will ask. And so there can be a disconnect between the patient's expectations and the doctor's.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, though, how much of the reluctance of the doctor to step up and say, look, we had a problem here, does indeed have to do with their concerns about the possibility of lawsuits. So they're concerned about what their potential liability is. So they're not going to come right out unprompted and say, oh, by the way, this we had a problem here.
Right. It's very complicated for the provider. So on the one hand, they're concerned about liability. Some studies looking at physicians in different litigation climates, so climates that involve different rates of patient claiming, all of them have some of the same rates of disclosure. So while litigation is in the background and is a concern to doctors, it's probably not the only thing, right? So even without litigation, it's hard to step up and say, I messed up. Right. And to take responsibility for having sometimes very seriously injured another person. So there are litigation concerns. There are sort of self-esteem concerns. And doctors worry that sort of their competence will be called into question. And that's a very difficult thing to do.
And just
bit of a vicious cycle. On the one hand, the providers are sometimes they've been conditioned both by their training and often by the liability insurers not to say too much, and that in turn makes the patient or their relative suspicious about what they might be hiding. And so then you get into antagonistic situations where neither side is prepared to talk and to diffuse a situation, and then they end up in court or have to, get their lawyers to settle the matter.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I just really want to underline to make sure that people hear this is that when we're talking about the importance of an apology in a case like this, we are certainly not saying, nobody is saying that's apology in lieu of appropriate compensation, follow-up care, you know. So I just want to make sure people know that we're not just saying, oh, if the doctor just says, I'm sorry, and that's it. That is not what we're saying.
That's right. There's a quote from Desmond Tutu that I like that says, if you take my pen and you apologize, but you don't give me back my pen, nothing has happened. And the same thing you could think of in this context, if there's a medical error and you say you're sorry, but you don't do anything to remedy that, nothing has happened. And so for many patients, there are all sorts of financial needs that they need to be remedied in the wake of an error, but an apology can help pave the way to get those financial needs resolved. It might be the case that it could be in lieu of some of that compensation, but more likely it's going to be speeding the way and making the parties be able to talk about things to get the financial needs dealt with.
It would be, I suppose, it may be a separate but connected question whether it would be a good goal to reduce the number of lawsuits. So that's a different question. But I want to ask Professor Humpkin, because I think this is something you've done some work on, is if you could institutionalize this kind of process that we're talking about here, that is, there would be disclosure of errors and then for providers, doctors, hospitals, whatever, to work with people to try to see their needs taken care of. Is there reason to believe that if you could do that, there would, in fact, be fewer lawsuits?
Yes. The University of Illinois Medical Center at Chicago instituted a comprehensive process for dealing with patient injuries and addressing unanticipated adverse events in April 2006. And the time that has elapsed since the program was implemented is not long enough to yield any definitive conclusions at this point, but so far there's no evidence that it increases the number of claims filed. That also makes sense because this process was specifically designed to address all the concerns that patients and their providers might have in the wake of a serious patient injury. So if you address those, you'll be able to avoid the claims. So the harder question is, does it increase the payments? Does it become more costly for the medical center? And there's no conclusive evidence on that either. But I think we can safely say it's not led to an avalanche of lawsuits, and it's not bankrupted the university at this point. So the program has been very successful in bringing about much better communication between patients who've been injured and their providers, and it's also led to a much swifter resolution of the claims or the potential claims, mm-hmm. certainly relative to what happened before the program was implemented.
And has there been an effort to talk to people afterwards and simply say to them, give us some indication of your degree of satisfaction with how all of this was resolved, and whether people say, yes, you know, pretty much I'm okay with how this worked out, or no, they're not, or something in between?
Well, there's anecdotal evidence. There's some egregious cases that resulted in very serious patient harm that were resolved, and the patients themselves or the relatives, they've maintained contact with the hospital. They've continued to seek care there. And they've also been enlisted in providing feedback to the providers about possible measures to prevent a recurrence of the incident. If anything, it's improved patient-provider relations rather than make them worse. And it's most likely due to the proactive nature of dealing with these patient injuries, because that's that's been addressing the fundamental concern of many patients, that they would like to know why they're in the situations that they didn't expect, and to get some recognition on the part of the hospital. And they certainly received that. Mm.
Let me just quickly introduce again our guests for folks who might have just recently tuned in. Then we have some callers I want to get to. On the telephone, Lawrence Helmkin. He is assistant professor in the School of Public Health at University of Illinois Chicago, and he is now visiting fellow in health and aging research at the National Bureau of Economic Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And he's there this morning talking with us by phone. Here in the studio with us, Jennifer Robinholt. She is professor of law and psychology here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. She's particularly interested in things like psychology and law, and in torts and in dispute resolution. We're talking this morning about apologies and medical error. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with them. We'll start with someone in Iroquois County on our toll-free line. That's line 4. Hello.
Yes, I'd just like to say that my parents have doctored for years at the Champaign facility that considers itself to be the best in the area. And my father had had a number of surgeries there and always had really good luck with them and was happy and everything. But when you're dealing with animate and inanimate objects, sometimes things go south. And about 5 years ago, he had an episode of clinical depression, and the meds weren't helping, so it was determined that perhaps he should have an electroconvulsive shock treatment, known as ECT, and that it was, these days it's because of muscle relaxants and what have you, it's not as quote-unquote barbaric as it was in times past. And at 85, he was a little reluctant to do this, but finally he agreed, and he had the first one, and it did wonders for him, and they did a second one, and there was some sort of glitch. We've heard multiple reasons why, but the muscle relaxant didn't get in, and he massively convulsed. And the doctor said that and apologized, what have you, after the procedure, but he said, oh, he'll be fine in a few hours, and sent him home. Well, he was totally helpless and was in excruciating pain. And on Mother's Day, 2 days later, we took him to the ER, where they kind of ignored our suggestions that his arm should be x-rayed, but admitted him to the hospital, where he pretty much just got painkillers for a couple days till a new rotation of hospitalists come on duty and somebody looked beyond the fact that his chart said he was a psych patient and actually listened to him and sent him off to x-ray, and it was determined that one of his arms was broken right below the socket, one was broken through the socket, and ultimately it was determined also his rotator cuff was torn. Obviously, no one was happy about this, and little was done for him. They, you know, dismissed him from the hospital. He ended up going to a nursing home for 3 weeks, went home, was still pretty much helpless, overbalanced one morning, fell against the door, broke his nose, and ended up back in an ER again. And, you know, that this problem happened wasn't so much the problem, it was that it was kind of swept under the rug and nothing was done about it. That was the problem. And it ended up that Medicare and my parents had to bear the cost of and the inconvenience and the pain and suffering. And basically the health providers, they got paid, but, you know, there was no cost to them at all. And I think that a lot of lawsuits could be avoided to medical providers if they would not only say they're sorry, but they would be willing to accept some costs, perhaps a reprimand their license or something like that, but something that comes out of their pocket or their reputation and not as passed on then to other consumers, et cetera.
Well, I don't know how the guests would like to comment on that.
I think the sort of every story is unique and everybody's got their unique experience, but the theme that we hear when we hear stories like this is that sort of post-error relationship is really important. Sort of patients who feel like things are swept under the rug are more likely to be suspicious or to feel like they need legal representation or to file a lawsuit, in contrast to patients who feel like their providers are being upfront with them and straightforward and giving them the kind of information that they feel like they need in order to cope with the aftermath of the error.
I just like to say that my parents, you know, they did not, you know, pursue legal action, but I don't think that the health providers treated them properly either.
Well, I thank you for the story. I don't know, Professor Helmkin, did anything you would want to say?
Yes. I mean, this is unfortunate, and sometimes the medical providers themselves don't immediately recognize that there was a problem, but I agree that this could have been handled very differently. And it would also help the hospital and the physicians to recognize more openly and more readily that there was care that wasn't really appropriate, apparently. And that would, you know, once you institute a process of greater reporting intensity, then you're more likely to catch these mistakes early on and prevent them in the future, and that helps save costs both for the patients and the healthcare system.
My father had about 20 years before had a procedure done at this same institution, and the doctor was concerned because he was using a new piece of equipment that he was kind of unfamiliar, you know, not totally familiarized with, that he might have done some sort of burn a hole in, you know, one of my father's intestinal areas, I think it was. And he put him through the procedure again to make sure that there was not any after effects. And, you know, they could have, when they saw this convulsion, they could have sent him to radiology, and this, you know, this problem could have probably been short-circuited and probably dealt with several days sooner, and, you know, it would have not left quite as bad a taste in people's mouths.
Right. I think this is perhaps representative of many patients who will recognize that physicians aren't perfect, but they're also not happy when information is withheld from them that that they think they should know about to make an informed decision about subsequent care. I would also like to mention I've had the opportunity. I have a joint affiliation with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, and I've had an opportunity to conduct a survey of about 1,000 Illinois residents, how they would respond to the disclosure of a medical error to them, and specifically if they would continue to recommend the hospital where they suffered the injury to close friends and family for the same procedure. And what the survey results suggest that patients are and respondents are actually quite flexible, and they're willing to recommend the provider in about 60% of the cases if there's a policy of routine disclosure. So disclosure doesn't necessarily alienate patients from the hospital and their physician. It's really a matter of having in place a robust policy of honesty with a patient. I think that can diffuse a lot of antagonism up front.
Well, I want to thank the caller.
I was going to add that I find those results interesting, and people want to trust their doctors. And I think sometimes they find the disclosure of error not as a cause for concern about the error itself, but as a reason to trust the physician because they feel like the physician is being straight with them.
Which is interesting because my guess is that there are probably a lot of physicians who would not want to disclose errors because they would think that then that would lead people not to trust them.
Right, right.
Well, the problem with error disclosure is that you're giving patients two pieces of information. One, you made a mistake, which patients don't like. But on the other hand, given that you made a mistake, you've been honest with them and you've been forthcoming, and that's what patients like. So sometimes it will depend on the nature of the mistake that you made. If it's an egregious mistake that should never occur, patients may run for the hills. But if it's something that could have happened, you know, that was an honest mistake, as they call them, if it was a mistake that any provider could have made, then the second effect may dominate. So patients will appreciate the honesty and the fact that they can start thinking about remediation as soon as possible.
Yeah. Well, I would certainly want to thank the caller. I have someone else here who's been waiting patiently, and I want to get along to them. This is someone in Indiana on line two. Hello.
Hello. It's too bad this wasn't done a couple of months ago when the advertisers were going crazy about all the doctors leaving Illinois because of the cost of lawsuits and things. So it sounds like that's not really true. What I wanted to ask about is, what do the medical schools teach their doctors about this? It certainly doesn't sound like they're on the honor system at all. And I'd wonder, just commonly, you hear the stories about the hemostat left inside the gut and stuff like that. Do general practitioners ever get sued for, say, giving out too much medicine, you know, too many milligrams or the wrong one for a specific case and at hand, or is it basically surgery that gets the hit on these kinds of things? Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Okay. Well, I don't. Do you? I don't know. Either you have much insight in this question about when people go through med school, how they're taught about this, or how people talk about this.
I think in the past, even the recent past, they weren't taught much at all about this. But there are a number of medical schools who are now incorporating this sort of thing into their curricula and starting to try to teach medical students about disclosure of errors and apologizing. One thing that would be interesting, and I don't know that there's been much detailed empirical work looking at this, but sort of how those messages are received and how they are in the context of sort of the culture of medicine. So the medical students are getting information from their classes, and they're also getting information as they engage in patient care in hospitals. And so I think part of the job is in the medical school, and part of the job is sort of a cultural shift, perhaps as more of those new med students enter the profession and more hospitals adopt policies like the U of I medical system, to start creating a culture where disclosing error and talking about errors is common.
Yeah, the University of Illinois Medical School, they've begun to integrate all these different aspects of disclosing medical errors to patients into the curriculum. It's become pretty much standard now for at least this institution. And they also conduct a two-week intensive patient safety elective that advanced medical school students can enroll in to learn about this. It represents a little bit of a paradigm shift because disclosing medical errors is not easy, and it requires a lot of practice and a fully fledged game plan to do it well, because badly done disclosure may only alienate further the patient. It's not enough just to say, I'm sorry. There needs to be a comprehensive plan of remediation attached to it. So it's been they've begun to implement this.
I think the education has several different prongs to it. So there's the sort of, how do you do it? How do you apologize in a way that's going to be effective? And then there's also sort of the attitudinal sort of, why would we want to do this? And is this going to be a good thing for ourselves and for our patients and for the practice of medicine? And I think both of those pieces need to be part of the education.
Maybe just to try it also to answer the other question that the caller raised, particular specialties that are most likely to be the target of a suit. I'm guessing that is the more invasive the procedures you're doing, that's going to be more likely. And I guess is it obstetrics is the number one specialty likely to be sued? I don't know, Professor Humkin, do you know?
I'm not sure if it's the number one specialty, but there are. It's definitely up there, along with, I think, neurosurgery, orthopedic surgery, any kind of procedure that carries a risk of causing substantial injury to the patient will be very costly, and so that will be patients who've been injured in a serious way are at greater ease of attracting lawyers who will represent them, as Professor Robinold already pointed out. So the minor injuries typically do not result in a suit. because it's difficult for patients to find legal representation.
Okay. We're a little bit past the midpoint of this hour of Focus. Let me again introduce our guests. Joining us by telephone, Lawrence Helmkin. He is assistant professor in the School of Public Health at University of Illinois Chicago, also has an affiliation with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. He is right now visiting fellow in health and aging research at the National Bureau of Economic Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Here in the studio with me is Jennifer Robinolt. She's professor of law and psychology here at U of I Urbana-Champaign. And in her work, she's particularly interested in bringing together psychology and the study of law. She is interested in things like torts and also dispute resolution. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. One of the things that I was interested in having Professor Robinolt here talk about and Professor Helmkin, you also may want to add on to that, is how common is it to have some kind of institutionalized structure for doing this? We talked about, for example, what's happening at the University of Illinois Chicago and their health facility. If you look at hospitals and clinics across the country, how many places are they actually trying to have a structure to do this?
I think it's becoming more common. I don't know an exact figure, and I would say it's probably still in the minority, but more and more institutions are adopting programs like the one at the U of I. One of the first ones was at a VA hospital in Kentucky. It's the one that's written the most about, but a number of other institutions, the University of Michigan, Johns Hopkins, have all adopted some kind of approach like this to sort of institutionalize a policy of early disclosure and compensation.
And Professor Helmkin, anything you
well,
can
these
add
programs on? Remain in the minority at this point. More institutions claim they have processes than they actually do. There are protocols at many hospitals, but it's not quite clear how strictly they're followed. And it requires a high degree of commitment on the part of the hospital leadership to institute this, because it really represents a departure from the conventional way of dealing with medical errors.
There are also at least, I think, a couple, maybe one or two insurance companies that have started to try to encourage their insureds to apologize. And that, again, that's also in the minority, and there's variation in how that's implemented.
We were talking earlier about how, you know, for physicians this may be a difficult thing, or it may just be something that they're not really comfortable doing, or you know, for a variety of reasons not to be inclined. I guess I wonder, has there been much effort to actually talk with physicians and say to them, well, you know, just tell us in a general sort of way what you think about the concept, and do you think that would be a good thing to try to take on, even if you might also say, you know, in addition, though, I would have some reservations about it.
Right. There have been some studies, sort of surveys of physicians and interviews with physicians, sort of focus groups where they get groups of physicians together to talk about this. And the general finding is that many of them say they would like to apologize. Sort of in the abstract, they feel bad when they make a mistake and would like to apologize to the patient. But, you know, concerns about litigation, advice from hospital risk management or from the insurance company suggest that they ought not to do it. So there's some sense that physicians would be quite interested in coming up with a system in which they could feel comfortable apologizing. There have also been studies asking physicians about their actual practices, sort of, do you apologize? Have you apologized? What would you say if you had this patient and this error happened? And the results suggest that physicians are sort of all over the map on what they think an apology would sound like, sort of running the gamut from, I'm sorry that you were injured in this procedure and here's what happened and here's what I did wrong, to, I'm expressing sympathy for your injury, and sort of using sort of euphemisms for what might have happened and less of an explanation. So there's sort of the sense that they want to do it, but perhaps they don't know sort of how to do it in a way that would be effective.
Without a structured process and proper support, I think it's only prudent for physicians to be very cautious about going forth and disclosing a lot of information. I completely agree, most would probably like to do it, but they expose themselves to significant risks, especially if there's no ancillary plan of remediation, of a plan to put into place process improvements to prevent a recurrence, any kind of future involvement of the patient in the hospital safety patient safety efforts. So it remains a bit of a risky proposition, especially if the disclosure does not occur too often and physicians don't have enough practice. The University of Illinois Hospital has created a patient communication consult service that's available around the clock for physicians and other medical staff to support them in their disclosure effort, and they will have senior physicians who are experienced in doing an actual disclosure, so just to ensure that it goes smoothly and to anticipate patient reaction.
So this was a case where a physician would go to this body and say, look, I here's this problem. I don't know how to talk about it. Can you help me figure out how to talk about it? Or is it that they actually, somebody else who perhaps maybe has more experience is actually directly involved in making the apology?
Both. Typically, the person involved in the patient's care is encouraged to be present, at least be present in when the disclosure is made and the first communication is made. But sometimes patients are too distressed that they do not want to see the physician, and then they will send someone else. But everyone at the hospital is encouraged to immediately report any type of incident to the risk managers, who will then dispatch that consultation service.
That, I guess, gets at another question, and it may be that this is different everywhere you go, but what sort of institutional structures do, say, hospitals and clinics have for dealing with errors internally? You know, what happens when clearly everybody knows something bad has happened? Then from that point forward, what do they do? I'm assuming that there are structures and that there are committees of senior administrative people, and no doubt the legal representation gets involved, and all sorts of people come into the room to start talking about what happened and what sort of response is the right one.
Yes. In the past, it seems that a lot of physicians were reluctant to even admit any kind of adverse incident, but out of fear that, one, they just would be shamed and publicly if they admitted this and essentially lost their credibility as a skilled physician, and second, that they would that this would not result in any kind of process improvement or any kind of change in the operating procedures that would, you know, prevent this error from happening again. And so they were too frustrated to even and too afraid to report the incident. So what you would need is a reporting system that can be activated at any time that will result in an immediate response by the risk managers, and then also the assurance that there is support for the caregiver all along the way by the hospital, that there will be a good faith effort made to investigate the incident fully, and that if the hospital determines that the care was reasonable, that there will be no corrective action, but there will be psychological support offered for the physician who was involved and all the other members of the medical staff. You also need, and then you need the assurance that the risk managers will handle the interaction with the patient and their relatives well.
We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guests joining us by telephone, Lawrence Helmkin. He is assistant professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois, Chicago. He is now visiting fellow in health and aging research at the National Bureau of Economic Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Here in the studio is Jennifer Robinholt. She's professor of law and psychology here at University of Illinois. And questions welcome. We're talking about apologies and medical error and about how physicians and health institutions deal with it when there's been a mistake and somebody gets hurt. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to ask Professor Robinholt, and I don't know if this is something you've thought about, but since you are professor of both psychology and law, I guess I'm thinking about how our attitudes enter into this in the sense of how people go into, say they're going to have medical treatment, how they go into that thinking about the possibility that something could go wrong. And then how it is, you know, on the other side, maybe if something has gone wrong, how people think about that, and whether they, you know, the one extreme would be to say something really bad happened, something really bad was done to me, and someone has to pay. Sort of from that, sort of to the other end that says, well, you know, bad things happen, and it may not really be anybody's fault.
Yeah. So going into a procedure. I haven't thought about this in any great detail, but we do know in psychology that people tend to be overly optimistic about their own outcomes. So that raises some issues for the informed consent process, because we're often talking about procedures that have inherent risks. So one of the complications in this area is when something bad happens, sometimes it's because there was an error. Sometimes it's because it's an inherent risk of the procedure. So I would speculate that even when hearing about the inherent risks of a procedure, patients would tend to think, okay, that's fine, but that's not going to happen in my case. On the outcome end, we know that people, when something happens, they try to make sense of it, and they try to attribute some cause to the bad outcome. So they look for what are the possible causes of this outcome. And there's a tendency when we're looking for causes of things that have happened to make what we call in psychology dispositional attribution. So we locate the cause in the other person. So this happened because you were a bad doctor might be one attribution that's made. When we're the doctor, our attributions tend to be situational. Right? This happened not because of something internal to me, but because of the situation, because of something external that happened that resulted in this bad outcome. And it's another place where there may be a disconnect in sort of how the provider is construing what happened and how the patient is construing what likely happened. Underlining again the importance of communication so that the provider can explain sort of what all the various factors were besides the competence of the care, and the patient can articulate his or her reaction and attributions. And it's more likely that they will come together on a sort of a common understanding of the causes of the injury if they're able to have that kind of communication process.
Let's talk with some other callers here. Let's see. We got three. We'll try to get them all in. We'll start with Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello. Yes. I was calling because I have heard in the past about an effect from shows like CSI on the practice of criminal law and what jurors expect in the courtroom. And I was sort of wondering if there's a similar effect from shows such as House or ER, where patients have a certain expectation that's been built up within our media culture of how doctors should behave. And I'll take my answer off the line. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting question. Have an answer for that?
I can speculate that it's probably inevitable that what we see in the media affects our expectations for physicians. And we may have a heightened expectation that they'll be able to do something to fix our problems. And then when that isn't, in fact, the case in reality, we may be disappointed.
Yeah, that's this is really interesting. We've actually had a conversation about this on the program in the past, this thing that they call the CSI effect, that we have now so many television programs with dramatic depictions of forensic medicine and the kind of tools that scientists use to try to figure out, you know, who did what, try to get an answer in criminal cases. And so what happens is that when people are on juries now, that they have an unrealistic expectation of the ability of, say, the prosecution and the police and the investigators to thoroughly explain what happened and with total certainty for them, you know. And so they want to believe in DNA evidence, and they want to believe in other kinds of things, and want to believe that will deliver an absolute concrete answer to what happened. Well, in the real world, it's not like that. But people come in with those kinds of expectations. So you wouldn't be surprised to see, if people watch a lot of doctor shows, they think that means that doctors should be able to figure out what's wrong and fix it.
Well, one problem also is that it's very hard for patients and their relatives to know whether the doctor really rendered inappropriate care or substandard care, which would be grounds for, you know, a lawsuit. That's why the discovery process is so costly and lengthy and so uncertain in yielding a verdict for either side. And so that's really what's driving a wedge between the compensation that patients should receive if the care was truly negligent and what they actually receive. One alternative, if we go back to the fundamentals, I guess the medical malpractice liability system is supposed to provide some kind of insurance against being the victim of negligent care or just suffering a bad outcome, whether it be due to negligent care or not. But there are alternative compensation mechanisms, and I'd like to point out just one. Mm-hmm. That would be strict liability. So other countries, they compensate patients on a schedule, mostly based on simply the outcome. They will investigate too closely whether the outcome was caused by the physician or not. But the patients are much more certain to get compensation for when they suffer a bad outcome.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose this also, it gets us in an entirely different area, something you probably would talk about for a long time, and that is in the case of medical malpractice, if someone is making the claim that they were harmed by poor practice by a doctor, then who is it who decides what's good practice? I mean, what's our benchmark that we're going to compare that against? And I suppose that it is other doctors that end up doing that, which is probably the right thing in one sense, because, you know, who else is going to know but other doctors? But I suppose that might lead to mistrust on the part of people who feel they were injured, because they're saying, well, of course, the other doctors, they're deciding, they're judging, they're passing judgment on one of their colleagues.
Yeah, so for medical negligence, the standard is what the standard of care is in the profession, right, which means other doctors. Although in cases that go to trial, it's the judge or the jury who makes that determination, and the medical professionals are expert witnesses to testify about what is the standard of practice in the profession and whether or not the care that was provided in the particular circumstances met that standard of care. And then it's up to the judge or the jury, a non-medical professional, to decide ultimately whether or not the doctor is liable.
Well, one more caller at least in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
In the courts that finds it difficult to expect a more immediate outcome on the particular cases. I heard that they're in the hundreds of thousands in different levels of courts. Could you comment on that, logjam?
Is the question clear? Is that it sounds like what the caller is saying is that we have this problem that there are a lot of people who are looking for their day in court, and they're basically standing in line because they're, you know, you can only deal with so many cases in a fixed amount of time.
So one of the benefits of sort of an early disclosure and apology and compensation kind of program is thought to be that we can move things along more quickly. Mm-hmm. We can get the parties together right from the outset of the error and work out a mutually acceptable resolution rather than requiring an extensive discovery process and an actual trial, which will take a very long time.
And I guess I find myself again going back to the very first point that you made is that if we're talking about medical malpractice, say we're talking about people who feel that they've been harmed as a result of medical procedures, most people have been harmed never go out and get a lawyer. Of those people who do, most of those are settled out of court. Of those that go to trial, in most cases, the plaintiff does not prevail. And in those few cases where the plaintiff prevails, you know, you have to ask, what do they get? How long does it take? And then I think for you'd have to ask, is this really, if what we want to do is do the best we can for a person that's been harmed, is that really the best way to do it?
So you're correct, right? Very, very few sue, right? Very few actually go to trial. And then my colleague David Hyman has found that recovery tends to be significantly lower than the actual trial verdict. I think something on the order of 50% less than the jury or judge actually awards. So I think it's a system that's in the backdrop of all the other things we've been talking about, and that's an important thing to have. But it's probably not the best resolution for the vast majority of cases. And in fact, the trial rate has been dropping pretty steadily over the last number of years. So we're actually having fewer and fewer cases that actually go to trial and many, many more that are getting resolved out of court.
And I think that's interesting and something it's good for something to people to bear in mind, just because I think our perception is actually the opposite, that we have this runaway problem. And that we have all these lawsuits and we have all these big judgments. And it seems that, in fact, that's just not the case.
Right. The popular perception is lots of trials, lots of litigation, right? We're a litigious society is what you often hear.
Yeah.
And the data suggests that that's really not the case.
We're just about the point where you're going to have to finish. Let me ask Professor Humkin and, you know, sort of last thought you'd like to leave with people who are listening.
Well, I think if they get injured, they should be proactive in talking to their medical providers and ask a lot of questions and engage them. I think that's the that's what I would advise any patient to do.
Mm-hmm.
On the part of the hospitals, I think we'll see. There's a promising start for some that provides early evidence of the effectiveness of disclosure programs, and we'll have to wait for a few more years to get some more conclusive answers.
Okay. Well, at that point, I think we're going to have to finish up with our thanks to our guests, Lawrence Humkin. He is assistant professor in the School of Public Health at University of Illinois Chicago, also has a joint affiliation with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Right now, he's visiting fellow in health and aging research at the National Bureau of Economic Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Professor Humkin, thank you.
Thank you
very much. Here in studio with us, Jennifer Robinault. She's professor of law and psychology here at University of Illinois. Thank you.
Thanks.